Okay, we are live in the Bradino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village, City of New York. We will start today as we always do. For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. To those who have been here before, welcome home. It's an honor today to welcome Garrett Kramer, the author of Still Power, Excellence with Ease in Sports and Life. I got to Garrett by somebody who happens to be an esteemed guest in our crowd tonight. The great hockey agent, Jay Grossman, told me I should contact Garrett, and that's how we got in touch. And this book is very different, as Garrett and I were discussing before we started the podcast. This is very different from anything we've ever done before in the clubhouse. It's not a baseball-specific book, although baseball is touched upon quite a bit in the book. So I think what we'll do is we'll, as we get into our discussion, we'll bring up some of those baseball examples, because as I read through the book, which I thought was terrific, I realized the baseball examples were just examples for somebody who loves baseball, but it's really about anything in life. So we'll get into that. But I think and just before we get going, for those of you at home, once again, it's Still Power by Garrett Kramer. Garrett is the founder and managing partner of Inner Sports. He has provided consulting and or crisis management services to hundreds of athletes and coaches, from well-known professionals, Olympians, and teams to high school and collegiate players across a multitude of sports. A former collegiate ice hockey player, Garrett is credited with bringing the principles of mind, consciousness, and thought to the athletic community at large. And tonight, he brings all of his expertise to the clubhouse. So thank you, Garrett.
Thanks for having me.
I think the best way to start is if you could just describe Still Power. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Still Power, in a word, is the opposite of willpower. So it's commonly believed and taught by parents, coaches, teachers, that when you're struggling, it could be in sports, it could be in business, it could be in relationships, when you're struggling, the way through is to grind it out, will yourself through, force it, actually. But that's kind of like stepping on the gas pedal with your tires in mud. If you're in a low state of mind and you're not seeing life clearly, my point is that the worst thing you could do is try to will yourself out of it. The opposite, being still power, points people in a totally different direction. Still power says that the human mind is designed to regulate to clarity, to consciousness, freedom, provided you don't do anything. That's what still power is. Now, the best example to get you all in the ballpark is to point you in the direction of young children. So if you look at two-year-olds, terrible twos, you hear about terrible twos. So two-year-old children are prone to temper tantrums, meltdowns, I mean, they just freak out. But with no skill, with no will, with no strategy or coping mechanism, what happens? They snap out of it, and they go right back to consciousness. So that's what I'm pointing people towards in this book, that the human mind is designed, if left alone, to regulate back to clarity. Willpower on one hand, still power on the other.
And how difficult is it for a child, a two-year-old, they're just doing it. They don't realize. For an old man like myself, how difficult is that to get that back?
Well, it's interesting. Sorry, it's interesting. We're all kind of limited by the degree to which the outside world has shrouded that understanding I just talked about. And that kind of happens arbitrarily. So you could have, for example, in my household, I was the oldest of three children. And I can tell you that my brother and sister kind of have gone through life relatively unscathed, whereas I, you know, until I saw it 20 years ago, I struggled much more than that. Now, we grew up in the same circumstances, same parents, yet for whatever reason, the outside world kind of just shrouded my intuition a little more than it did theirs. So the degree to which that's happened is the degree to which you can kind of wipe away the layers. So I've worked with people where they'll come in, I'll point them in this direction, I'll say just what I said tonight, and they'll be like, oh my God, that's it. I'll have people come in, I'll say the same thing, and be like, what are you talking about? Of course, if I'm in a low place, I've got to do something about it. I've got to make a change. Of course. It's all about hard work. They won't see it. So there's no real rhyme or reason to that. But in my mind, what I've found is that the understanding of how the system works, what's happening behind the scenes in our own head, is far more valuable than the self-help strategy. Far more valuable.
All right, so let me ask this question. I find this fascinating. I've always found this example fascinating, and I'd like to get your thoughts about this. I used to work with Jay Grossman for a sports agent firm, mm-hmm. and one day, I'd rather not say who it is, but one day I was taking this client around to meet people at ad agencies. We were trying to get him endorsement deals. He's in the Hall of Fame today, so as far as his talents on the field go, it's one of the greatest to ever play baseball. And I remember we got back to the team hotel, and we still had, you know, it was still fairly early in the day. They were playing a game that night. And I said, oh, what are you going to do now? He goes, I need to go to my room now. I need to visualize everything that's going to happen in the game tonight and prepare for the game. Think about the pitcher who I'm facing, what type of pitches he throws, what each bat may look like, and so forth. This was a guy who was, it was either his last, I believe it was his last year or his next to last year, in a very long, very successful career, and he was still doing this. Mm-hmm. How does something like that come into play?
Well, it looks like, it may even look to him, it may look to you, it may look to his coaches, to his teammates, that routine is what partly contributed to his success, but it really doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. It's never behavior. It's always state of mind. Now, so any type of practice that way will always, it'll look like there's a cause and effect relationship, but it just doesn't work that way. Now, I'd like to get back to that, but speaking specifically about visualization, because that's what he said he was going to
right.
do. You can't purposely visualize. In other words, if you take me at my word that human beings exist in a continuum of states of mind, let's say like an elevator in a hotel, penthouse, basement, right? And that elevator is kind of going up 24/7. Our moods are going up and down. We can all feel that moment to moment. Now, when we're in the penthouse, call it the zone in sports, we don't have to try to visualize. We're five steps ahead of the play. That's Gretzky, five steps ahead of the play. We're seeing into the future, deja vu, stuff like that. That's what's happening. We don't try to visualize. It just happens. As our level of consciousness or state of mind descends, though, and we're down near the basement, we're not capable of visualization. We're just not. And if we force it from that place, it's like stepping on the gas pedal with your ties in mud, you're going lower. So that's what I'm saying. We can't force it and will ourselves to see the picture. And I think athletes waste a lot of time. And what they actually do in trying to do that is they rev up thought as opposed to slowing down thought, which is what great athletes generally do. So that's the point about visualization. As far as the other point about having a routine or a strategy and it appearing like that strategy is what leads to success, it just doesn't work that way. Let me give you an example that everybody's going to know about. If you look at weight loss, weight loss strategies, Weight Watch or Jenny Craig, whatever, I think the data says that 96% of people who go to weight loss centers end up not keeping weight off permanently. They may lose weight, then they gain it back a month later or whatever. We've seen that, our friends and stuff. It happens all the time. So it's 96 out of 100 do not succeed long term. But what happens with the 4? So why the 4 out of 100 succeed long term? Now, the weight loss center will say, well, it's because those are the 4 that stuck to the plan. But it can't be a very good plan if only 4 out of 100 succeed. So what is it? What is it? It's not the strategy. There's something else at work. And in my mind, what's at work is those 4 rise above the strategy, the tools and techniques, the self-help mechanism of the plan. Their state of mind, remember, that arbitrarily defaults to the penthouse. And from that level of consciousness, from the zone, we have insights, we have epiphanies, we have that aha moment where we say, that's it, I have the answer. That's what happens. So it looks like in that situation, it's the weight loss center that's led the person to the epiphany, but it just doesn't work that way. The epiphany happens independent of circumstance.
So that's a question that relates to baseball in particular, although I think it then relates to life more so than some of the other sports may. In hockey, the game is obviously extremely fast. To some degree, basketball and football, everything's happening in a second. Baseball, a lot of the game is, there's not much going on from an action standpoint. You have much more time to have your mind do good things or bad things in the middle of the game, which in some ways makes it extremely, extremely difficult to compare to some other sports in some ways. So what are some secrets that somebody may, or not secrets, but what are some tips for somebody in baseball? For example, you'll hear this a lot, or you'll even see it, even in the major leagues. A player's in a batting slump. Now he goes into the field, he's out in right field, and he's fooling around with his swing, and he's obviously not paying any attention to what's going on in the game and what he's supposed to be doing. And that's kind of an extreme example, but in general, there's a lot of time to have things go wrong, basically, for an athlete. What does an athlete do? And it's kind of like life, because things are not really happening as fast as they are not in a hockey game, let's say.
Athletes who struggle, and to me, the pace of the game is kind of neutral. It doesn't really mean much.
It doesn't?
No. Athletes or people who struggle have a lack of understanding about thought. So if you look at, and as you read my bio, we talked about mind, consciousness, and thought, those principles. So if you look at the principle of thought, people who understand the principle of thought generally have a very smooth journey through life. Now, when I talk about the principle of thought, I'm not talking about what you think. This is going to sound a little strange. What I mean about it is that you think, not what you think. So the Derek Jeters, the Jackie Robinsons of the world, they understood and understand that what we think, what they think, is meaningless. Thought is meaningless. The principle of thought is not. So Jeter understands that when the quality of his thinking drops, he feels off inside. Thoughts create feelings, which create state of mind. Your feelings are this barometer of your state of mind, of the quality of your thinking. They're guiding you. So Jeter has an errant thought. It manifests itself as a feeling. He recognized that he's looking in the wrong direction. His thinking's off course. And he changes gears immediately. He doesn't go there. People who struggle don't understand the principle of thought. They have a thought. They believe the thought, it's true, they go there. So if you look at an insane person, and it's my definition of insanity is someone who believes every thought that pops into their head. Every thought's real. we all get there from time to time. But on the opposite end of the spectrum, someone who would breeze through life would understand that no thought is true, zero. And we all exist somewhere in that gap. Again, people who have a smooth trip through life kind of exist on this side of the gap. Those of us who have a rocky road are on that side of the gap. But it all goes down to, at the end of the day, it's all about thought. And when I say no thought is real, I really mean that that's true. I'll give you a real funny example about this, because people ask me, they think I'm saying we should think positively, and I'm saying positive thought's not even productive. Negative thought, positive thought, it's all the same thing. I'll give you an example, a personal example. About a month ago, I wrote this. You might have read it, Josh, you might have read it. I wrote this about this in one of my articles. I'm watching my daughter's lacrosse game. She's 15, freshman in high school. And I am just captivated in my daughter. No thought. I am in the zone. I am in love right there. I am just high, watching my daughter. I'm thinking, but I don't notice my thinking. It's fluent as can be. But all of a sudden, this, out of nowhere, this thought pops into my head. My daughter's beautiful. This is my thought. Now, that sounds like a great thought, right? But you know what my next thought was? If I think my daughter's beautiful, that means the 15-year-old boys in the stands also think my daughter's beautiful. And I know what I was thinking when I was a 15-year-old boy. Those sons of bitches. I'm not letting them near my daughter. Now, I went from the zone up in the penthouse to the depths of despair in about 10 seconds. My feeling was like, ugh, what just hit me? Nothing hit me. Nothing changed. My daughter was still playing lacrosse. No one was even talking to me. This is all thought. Now, lucky for me, I kind of know about this. So I tapped into that errant feeling in my gut. I'm like, don't go there. Next thing, if you go there, you're going to lock your daughter in a room. That's not going to be productive for anyone. But many fathers do that, by the way. Just thought. They buy into their thoughts. They don't understand thought. And I just looked in a different direction, went back to the game, and kind of my mindset arbitrarily kind of went back up, regulated back to clarity. So it's really all about our understanding of the principle of thought. As I said, the Jackie Robinsons of the world understood thought. I mean, imagine Jackie Robinson. We look at it, I mean, to say that he didn't have vengeful or hateful thoughts is ridiculous. He's a human being. He's going to get stuck in his thinking sometime. But he recognized that the feeling in his gut was telling him he's not seeing it right. He's not seeing those people right. He didn't tend to those thoughts. He didn't think into that thinking. He didn't try to fix that thinking. And before long, a state of mind rises, and he's actually having compassion for the people that are, you know, who are hurling racial slurs at him. Thus, he played great baseball. He's free. He's free. So, you know, I hope that makes some sense. It's a little bit of, probably not the answer you thought you were going to hear, but that's how it works.
That's what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
But actually, I do have a question.
Sure.
Let's go back to your example with your daughter.
Mm.
So now you went from the zone to this place where you're ready to almost kill somebody.
Right, exactly.
And you obviously know how to get back to that zone. Is there any little, I know this is not like a simple fix, but what does somebody do who, for whatever the thought would be, who lost the zone, what do you have to work on to get back there, that like that?
This is really important. And I know it's going to seem like I'm not answering the question. The worst thing I would want to do to anybody is to give them the answer to that question. You know, it's kind of like being a parent. In my mind, the worst thing we could do is thwart their own free will, their own intuition, their own inner wisdom. So what I do in my work, what I do in this book, is I'm pointing people in a different direction, a direction that most of us have not considered. That we create our reality from the inside out, not outside in. That our state of mind in the moment will determine our perceptions. And we all know that, because we have situations in our lives that we look at one minute, and we're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? This is awful. And then we come back to the same situation a minute later, an hour later, a day later, a week later, whatever, and we look at it. What was I worried about? That's nothing. Now that happens? It happens, right? So it can't be the situation. It has to be us. It has to be. It has to be. Our thinking will change moment to moment, the quality of our thinking. So if you understand that that your perceptions are created from the inside out, you're steering the bus. You're not a victim to what happens out there. So, again, I point people in that direction. And I promise, if you look in that direction, the rest will take care of itself. Now, just to go back to what I said about thwarting free will. See, in my mind, all the do's and don'ts of the outside world, all these strategies and techniques and tips, etc., for mental well-being, all they do is rev up thought. And how that works is if you take your own inner wisdom, okay, Jay's own inner wisdom, and I give him the strategy. So you take Jay's intuition, his inner wisdom, I give him Garrett Kramer's strategy. Put those together and revved up thought. That's what happens. That's why people get bound up. That's why performance anxiety sets in. Because the outside strategy, long term, will take people down. It conflicts with your own inner wisdom. So in my mind, the best teachers, the best coaches, the best parents, they serve to bring out the inner wisdom of those they teach. They don't tell them what to do.
So that brings us to an area that I'd like to, if you could touch upon. We spoke about it a little bit before, but I didn't want to get into it too much before because I thought it would be fascinating. I can only imagine that teams, professional teams, are not exactly completely open-minded to a lot of what you're saying. And you do work with quite a few professional athletes. So do you prefer to work directly with the athlete? Or have the teams been negative in dealing with this, or have you approached them? Just a little bit about from a professional standpoint.
Well, general managers, player personnel guys and gals, they get caught up in their own insecurities like everyone does. So they want the strategy. They want the fix. They want the plan, the method. That they just been kind of groomed in that way. Now players and agents, they see it a little different. They kind of get that it's a little mumbo jumbo, that it just doesn't, like these strategies and these positive thinking techniques and stuff, they kind of intuitively know that it doesn't work. They're more creative. They're imaginative. They're instinctual. They know they play better when they're in that frame of mind. So when you start to give them these strategies, intuitively, and Jay and I have talked about this many times, they just like, this guy's nuts. Now, as opposed to what I'm saying, I'm pointing towards what they already have inside of them. So they tend to relate to it a little better. So, you know, my experience is that the players are much more in tune to looking within, whereas at times, as you said, the teams are looking outside of. So that's my experience.
Okay. And then there are a couple of very interesting examples in the book that related to baseball, but once again, they relate to life. So maybe if you could just touch upon some of those. A couple that I found fascinating. One was about a pitcher and what's called a comebacker. And maybe you can just describe that a little for people who may not completely understand what a comebacker means.
Right. This is a pitcher that I work with, a professional pitcher who got hit with a comebacker and got drilled pretty good.
And so
threw a pitch, ball came right back and it hit him in the shoulder at about 100 miles an hour, whatever it is. And it knocked him down. Now, it didn't really hurt him. He had a bad bruise, but he was okay. It was just catching shoulder, so it probably hit him in the best possible spot it could have hit him. But his thinking, he just couldn't get the thought out of his head. Now, the team psychologist was giving him all kinds of positive thinking strategies. all kinds of techniques and deep breathing and all these things. And there was no doubt in my mind that those external coping mechanisms were revving up thought. They were taking them down. They were magnifying the problem, turning a molehill into a mountain. So he found his way to me, and I taught him about the principle of thought. That's all I did. I taught him that. I remember saying to him that your thoughts are arbitrary. Your thoughts are totally arbitrary. You think that these thoughts are based on your experience, but that has nothing to do with it. So when he started to look in that direction, he still had fearful thoughts from time to time, but they were powerless. He realized it was thought. There was no reality to it. We have fearful thoughts walking across the street sometimes, but we don't get caught up in it. And he saw it for what it was. He saw the fearful thoughts as arbitrary, random, and meaningless. And when he started to look in that direction, it's not that he didn't have the fearful thoughts, but when he had it, they cleared out quickly. And over time, they became less and less frequent. So again, it was a player not doing anything about the thoughts. I said, you can still pitch with fearful thoughts. You can succeed with fearful thoughts. And the more he looked in that direction, the more he succeeded. And I'll tell you, it's a common misunderstanding, especially in sports, that you have to be in a perfect mindset to perform well. And that's ridiculous. You can perform well in an insecure mindset, in a fearful mindset, provided you understand how the system works, how the human mind works. So it's always the understanding. It's never the fix, in my mind.
And then there was another example about a pitcher's mound, or how pitcher's mounds are different, especially not away from the major leagues, let's say.
Right. So this is a situation that's pretty common in life. And I'll give you a good golf example with this also, is that pitchers tend to look to the mound, and you see it constantly. You see a bad pitcher, then he'll kind of brush the dirt or dig the mound, and a fielder will miss a ball and he'll look to his glove. And we're kind of conditioned again to believe that circumstances have power. But the more that you see that circumstances are neutral, the more you realize that pitcher's mounds are pretty irrelevant, and it's no matter what the mound is, we can succeed. So there's a great golf story, Gary Player, the famous golfer. He's going back a while, but this, I don't know, seven majors. I think he won South Africa, and he was on the tour, and he was traveling with Davis Love Jr., who's Davis Love III's father, and they were down in Florida, where the greens are. Bermuda grass. So they tend to be, especially in those days, they tend to be bumpy and slow. So I think Davis Love Jr. shot an 80 or something, and he's in the room, and he's waiting for Player to come in so he can commiserate about the greens. So Player walks in, apparently shot 68 that day, and Davis Love said to him, "What about those greens? Weren't those the worst greens, slowest, bumpiest greens you ever putted in your life?" He goes, "Oh, those greens were great. You could just ram it in the back of the hole, and you could make any putt you want. Those greens were perfect greens." So Davis Love says, "Okay, I guess he likes Bermuda greens." Player wins the tournament. So then they travel together, and that was the last leg of the Florida swing. So now they're up somewhere up north. Bent grass greens, tabletop, or like this floor, that fast. So Davis Love Jr. goes out, and he shoots a million again. He's knocking the putts by the hole because he thinks the other greens were slow. Now he's knocking the ball way past the hole, shoots a million again. He waits for Player. Player comes in. What'd you shoot? 67. Well, what about the greens? How did you... "I love bent grass greens. They're fast. They're great. All you got to do is touch it and get it going, and it holds its line." Gary Player knew that perceptions are created from the inside out. Circumstances are irrelevant. They're neutral. They're neutral. And again, pointing people in that direction is what I'm doing in this book. I'll give you a personal example. You guys can relate. Being married, I can walk in the front door of my house after a long day, and I've been married for 21 years, and my wife could do something And I could look at her and say to myself, how did I marry this person? What was I thinking? Then I could walk in the house the next day and my wife could do the exact same thing. And I could say, oh, I love her so much. That's why I married her. Now, it has to be inside out. Because again, my wife Liz will do the same thing. One day it looks like it's driving me crazy. One day I think it's adorable. It has to be me. It can't be her. And knowing that is what guides me and why we have such a productive marriage, in my opinion. Because we understand it's inside out. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not times where we disagree and we talk about it. But those times are done from the penthouse. They're not done when I think that my wife's causing my bad mood, because it's impossible. She has no ability to cause my bad mood. And that's what I'm saying to people. That's what I'm saying to people. So in athletics, this understanding is where resilience is born. Again, people who know it's inside out do not play victim to external circumstances, hardly ever.
We're gonna, right before we turn to our highly intelligent and varied audience for any questions, I just one question. I don't know if this makes any sense or not, but from your experience, you mentioned Derek Jeter, Wayne Gretzky, Gary Player, the greatest among the greatest in their field of all time. Do you think that they were kind of just born this way? Or is this, obviously anybody can learn this if they work at it, but do you think the super duper stars in whatever their field is, do you think they're kind of just different?
No. We're all born the same, is what I'm saying. The human mind works the same for all of us. Not brain. Biological. Brain's biological. That's going to be different. Mind's spiritual. We're all connected in the same way. So guys like you just mentioned, they, for whatever reason, and it'd be ridiculous to try to figure it out because you'll find circumstances are irrelevant. The Derek Jeters, the Jackie Robinsons of the world, their innate understanding was not kind of shrouded by the world out there. They just kind of kept it. Whereas, in my own personal life, I was the opposite when I was 25 years old. So, no, they're not different. They're different biologically, yeah, definitely. But as far as what we're talking about today, we all have this ability. We all own it, and we all have it. You know, to me, this understanding goes way beyond sports. I mean, people who... not understanding the commonality and the frailties of the human condition are the reason there's divorces in this world, the reason there's wars, there's bullying, there's famine, there's strife. It's that simple. If we could see that, you know, Josh's troubles are created for the exact same reason that my troubles are created, our thoughts. We don't grow up, our circumstances are different, but our troubles are created via thought. It's exactly the same for everybody. And again, that's what I'm pointing out. A good example, another example of what I'm saying, and I'm sure we've all seen the movie Forrest Gump. So the point of the movie Forrest Gump is there's a person who wasn't blessed or cursed with the power of thought. Not a lot of intellect. He was just kind of humming along on instincts, on inner wisdom, and he kicked butt in life. That's the point of the movie, and that's what we're pointing people toward in that direction.
Well, let's now turn it to our esteemed audience. Any questions?
Yeah. When you were talking about steering people towards almost an understanding rather than giving a solution, are you finding that people are using tools to make them almost actively making their mind inactive, or is it more of a matter of having more of a heightened awareness that it should be kind of baseline or still?
So, John, what you're saying is, do I find that people, before they read this book or before I talk to them, they're using those tools that we've sent?
Correct. Or, yeah. Or when they get to that point of understanding, are they being active in trying to...
Yeah, okay, I got it. Yeah. So that's a really good question. So the first part is, it's innocent, but we're all doing it to a certain extent. I mean, we can't turn on the television without being told that if we're tired to pick up a Red Bull or something, right? So we're constantly bombarded with these strategies to take us up to the penthouse, and all we do is grind our wheels at the end of the day, because our inner wisdom is just thwarted, right? So we can't help it to a certain extent. Now again, the people that you mentioned, Jay, they just know better than to go there. Now, it doesn't mean that Derek Jeter may not drink a Red Bull. He might, but he does it from here. He doesn't does it from inspiration. He doesn't do it from desperation. He knows better than to act from desperation. It feels off. He's not seeing life right. If he acts in that place, he's going to trip. He knows that. So he pulls back. Right? So a golfer, a good golfer, he may... His thinking may be revved up. He may shoot a bad round. He may feel the compulsion of the practice day. I got to go fix this now. But he knows better than to do that. He won't go there. Now, so I'll always tell players, like, should I practice? Should I not practice? Should I work on my game? Should I not? Well, I don't care what you do. I just care about the state of mind from which you do it. So hitting balls for 5 hours on a practice tee in golf or being in the batting cage in baseball is neutral. It's the state of mind from which you step in there that's going to determine your success or failure. So that's what I'm saying. Now, the second part of it is the question I really liked, is that once you see that the quality of your thinking and state of mind is guiding you, determining your perceptions, once you see that, how do you put that into practice? And this is going to sound like totally evasive, but it's so simple. It's so simple. I mean, take it from somebody, and you knew me when I was young. I was this grinded out athlete, grinded out businessman when I started out. I mean, I was going to outwork everybody. That was my mission. And over the last 20 years in this work, my understanding of what I'm talking about goes deeper every day, and there's no effort in what I'm saying. There is no effort. It doesn't mean I don't get revved up sometimes. I absolutely do. But that feeling is so guiding me that I'm not going there. I'm just not going there. So I can get cut off in traffic. Cut off in traffic. And one day, I'm like, I could kill this guy. How dare you come in my lane? Like, I take it personal. It happens. But I know it's inside out. I know it's not about the guy who just cut me off. It's me. Because the next day, the same thing can happen. I'll be like, oh, I hope he slows down. He may hurt somebody. He must have had a bad day. Poor guy. He doesn't even see I'm here. Go ahead. So it has to be me. So the potential, when I'm not seeing it clearly, or when a person's not seeing life clearly, it's understanding that the potential exists to see it differently that guides you. So take bullying, for example, something that I'm doing a lot of work in right now. If you look at it, it's kind of like the weight loss situation. You have a bullying specialist in virtually every high school in the country because it's a problem. Definitely. So that's the good thing. But it's getting worse. It's not getting better. It's not, they're not helping. So why aren't they helping? Well, because they're providing ground rules for how these kids should act. And that's just thwarting their own instincts. Now, pointing them in this direction is a whole another option. Because if the bully could see, wait a second, my state of mind is determining my perceptions of that kid over there. It's nothing to do with that kid. He's going to see, or she's going to see, that an option exists to see that kid differently. It makes no sense to bully. If you think that other person is causing you to feel low, it makes perfect sense that you would want to go kick his butt. But if you understand that that's got nothing to do with your low feeling, you don't think it's fun. It's actually that. It's that simple. It's that simple. Did anybody see this on the news the other day? This boy and his father were playing catch in their backyard. Anybody see this? And the boy wasn't catching the ball, and twice the father went over to the boy and whipped him with a belt. Now, people went bananas, and rightly so, obviously. Now, of course, the father said, "Do you know my son?" This had nothing to do with him not catching the ball. He was being disrespectful, and no one caught that on video. He was being disrespectful, yada, yada. So he had every right to whip him. So now, again, if this father thinks his perceptions are created outside in, then it makes perfect sense. I'm not giving him a pass by any means. It makes perfect sense that he would take a belt to him if he was being disrespectful. Because if that father thinks that that son's disrespect is causing him to feel the way he feels, he's got to take care of it. As opposed to the father that would know that his perceptions of her son are totally based on his own state of mind at that moment. He would never take a belt to his son. Virtually never. So, I mean, as a father, I can tell you, I have three fantastic children. They have been disrespectful at times. They definitely have. But my perceptions of their disrespect are totally based on me. Totally based on me. And knowing that is what provides the answers when I think that we need to work on something or I need to tend to their disrespect.
Have most of your clients come to you out of
semi-desperation? Yeah. Unfortunately, the answer is yes, Lee. I wish that wasn't the case. You know, and Jay can relate to that. I mean, I wish that wasn't the case because the fact of the matter is, and that this isn't a personal situation or even in performance, because if you're in that place, clearly you're not seeing life right. So I've got a little bit more uncovering the crap to do, right? So I'll tell, however, players that have gotten to know me, I'll tell them, I want you in here when you're playing great. Because that's our opportunity to go deeper. Because you're seeing it. You're conscious. You're going to hear me. You're going to feel it. So that's our opportunity. So unfortunately, I wish it was the opposite, but that's kind of the way it plays out. I had a guy in the Devils come in yesterday. He was with Devils. Clearly, he's been playing great. They've been playing great. We were talking about things that even blew my mind because he was in such a good place. I even learned from him and vice versa. It was crazy as opposed to me, you know, saying, hey, let's we got to wipe away these layers and let's get to it. So, yeah, that's how it works. Yes?
How different would the approach be with Josh Hamilton, you know, just fighting either chemical or mental addiction of some sort that is inhibiting otherwise, you know, obviously limitless?
Yeah, see, I wouldn't go near the chemical side of it. Again, the chemical side of it is not the cause of his trouble, though. Again, that goes back to the cause and effect. A misunderstanding about thought is that he has a thought disorder, not a chemical disorder. Josh Hamilton, I don't know him, his situation exactly, obviously, but in my mind, if he continues and he has this coach that travels around with him and keeps him on the straight and narrow, that's not going to work. You're thwarting his own inner wisdom. You're staying on top of him. You're hovering. And it won't work. It won't work. I'm positive. It's kind of like 10-step programs. I know that people stay off the booze and drugs because of them, but they're automaton. They're robots. They got to go there every day to the...
But he only really needs to do it during his playing career. Then he can take the training wheels off and try and make it a human being. But if he doesn't do it during...
Yeah, but I wouldn't care about his playing career.
He missed many good years of his playing.
Yeah, but it's a good point, but in my mind, I don't care about the playing career. So, the playing career is just neutral to me. And I think this is one of the reasons I've had some good success with players because they know that I am not here to make them 50 goal scorers. Now, a byproduct of this understanding, you're going to score more goals. A very famous sports psychologist came to one of my talks at Seton Hall University the Sunday before the Super Bowl. And he grabbed me after me and goes, you know, I really never looked at it the way he was a tool and technique guy. He was a hoverer. Give him strategy. If one strategy doesn't work, we're going to go to the next strategy, to the next strategy, to the next strategy. I mean, in my mind, that's just revving up thought. But be that as it may, he's written some books and all this, works for some teams. So he said, I really never considered it inside out the way you're describing it. And I think it's this value, which is really awesome that he said that to me. But I have a question. It says, in next week's game, which is the Super Bowl, if you were hired by one of those teams and the field goal kicker with 1 second left to go in the game had to kick a field goal that would win or lose the game, Scott Norwood kind of thing, isn't it your job, if you work for that team, to help him get in the right state of mind so he makes that kick? I said to him, no. My job is to show him that whether or not he makes the kick, his life's going to be perfectly all right. There's a big difference in that. There's a freedom in that. And to me, that's the direction guys like Hamilton are not being put in. The more he thinks that this guy's got to stay next to me for my career to be okay, the more his career is not going to be okay. The more he understands that he's going to be just fine whether he gets another home run or not, the more home runs he's going to hit. So that's kind of a different direction.
He is Jesus, though.
That's what he always
read. You have to read the sports illustrated.
Right, but unfortunately, Jesus, you know, I'm not here to give a referendum on religion, but again, that's outside in. So the principles that we're talking about are before Jesus, are before religion. So I'm not saying religion's right, wrong, or different. But we're talking about principles before religion, before the do's and don'ts of religion. So like, we're even talking about principles before, I use the word freedom a lot, before freedom. So if you don't understand thought, you're not going to be free. You're just not. And that's why I call them principles. They're not strategies or concepts. They're principles inherent to all of us. So we could say that we're born free and all this, but if you don't understand thought, you're the opposite of free.
The whole time I was sitting here, your words keep reminding me of what you learn in meditation, right? Meditation is all about the thoughts float by, you don't attach to them, you visit them, you smile at them, or whatever you want, but they don't matter at all. Is what you're saying very different than that? Am I missing something?
No, I think that if we go back to the principle of thought, the part about thoughts are meaningless, don't matter. And when you talk about in meditation, when they talk about letting your thoughts flow by, I would agree that a high state of consciousness is the byproduct of fluent thinking, where we don't notice our thoughts. Like I said about when I was watching my daughter play, I didn't notice my thinking at all until one stuck, which happens because I think. I'm a human being, so I think. So occasionally I'm going to overthink. Okay. Now, the difference, though, is it doesn't make sense to me to use meditation as a means to get out of a low. That, to me, that doesn't work. It just doesn't jive.
Why?
Well, because if you're in a low state of mind, let's go back to that elevator analogy. If you're in a low state of mind, you're not seeing life clearly. It's kind of like you're walking around with Vaseline over your eyes. You have blurry vision. So you're really not capable of using an external technique. You're not going to hear it right. You're not going to understand it right. Your thinking is kind of bound up or revved up. And 99% of the time you'll sit there and say, why is this not working today? Yesterday it worked. Why could I not get out of this place? Am I not doing it right? maybe I should visit a different meditative teacher, maybe I should do it a different form of meditation, etc. Because in that place, if you're looking to meditation as a means to getting out of this low state of mind, it won't work. It won't work long term. It won't work. I'm not saying meditation is good or bad. My wife does it every morning. But again, you're far better off, in my mind, meditating from a high state of mind as opposed to trying to use it to get out of that low state. If you meditate and you get out of the low state, like the weight loss, it'll look like it's the meditation. But that's not what's happening. Your state of mind is arbitrarily doing this, moment to moment. So you may get lucky, and when you meditate, it may look like it's the meditation. So then we say, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to suggest this to all my friends because it worked for me yesterday. But the truth of the matter is, it may not work tomorrow. Because again, state of mind is kind of arbitrary. That's what I'm saying. You know, in the term I use a lot of my players is stay in the game. Because hockey players, talking about fast game, they'll say, wait a second, I get what you're saying, but I'm playing a fast game. I don't have time to sit still, which I'm never saying sit still. So what I'm saying is stay in the game. Just play. If you just go about your business.
But aren't you saying don't attach to the state of mind?
Don't
attach to the state of mind.
I don't care, again, I don't care if you are or you're not. There's sometimes where I get really attached to my state of mind. I just get caught up in it. But I still know I'm looking in the wrong direction. So there's no strategy in that. You know, if you get attached to your state of mind, so what? So what? You know? It doesn't, I'm saying there's no harm in that, provided you know how the system works inside out. It doesn't really matter to me if you get attached to it. I'll give you a really cool example. This is a baseball example. My son, my middle child, is playing on this travel baseball team that just started up last weekend, high school ended. So I go to the first game, and the coach, who knows me and my work, says, I need to talk to you. I got a problem. Okay? I got a catcher who has the yips, Mackie Sasser. I got a catcher who has the yips. He can't throw the ball. This kid's a stud. He moved here from Arkansas last year. He was recruited as a sophomore. I mean, this kid's a Division I player, and I got him DHing because he can't throw the ball back to the pitcher. Oh my goodness, this poor kid. Okay, I'll take care of it. Jeez, that's easy for me. I'd love that opportunity because I know that they haven't been looking in this direction at all. So of course, me just being inquisitive, I said, "Well, what's going on? What have you been doing about it? What's he been doing?" Well, he's seeing a throwing specialist, and he's seeing a sports. He's Skyping with a sports psychologist in San Francisco, and the sports psychologist in San Francisco. He didn't say this. I went onto the sports psychologist website just out of curiosity, knowing what I was going to find. And right there on the front page is, "Do you have the yips? Take the test." I mean, talk about making people a victim of their own circumstances. Okay, I mean, it's just, oh my goodness, this is what the direction he's leading people in. And this is the yip doctor. Now, again, I'm not. It's this guy's trying to help, and according to this boy who I work with, which I'll tell you how that went, he's a super nice guy. But there's no doubt in my mind that the yip doctor was causing more problems. There's no doubt in my mind. Anyway, so what did I do? Well, the boy came to my house a week ago. Right now, actually. Because he wanted to see me right away. His parents wanted to see him right away. Desperation. Okay. Just what he was saying. He was coming to me out of total desperation. And I didn't even talk about throwing. You know, one of my mentors, George Kransky, once told me, if I've got an anorexic, I'm not talking about food. If I've got a couple of problems, I'm not talking about their marriage. Interesting. What we talk about is the human experience, how the mind works. They'll take the rest. They'll take it in their own direction. So anyway, in a nutshell, I explained to this young man, his mother, the father was away, how his perceptions are created. he was blaming, in his mind, it was new team, pressure to perform with scouts watching, pitchers getting mad at him, his parents being disappointed, his parents worrying, all these, everything was external. He wasn't looking to his own intuitive functioning as the source. He was totally looking out there for the reason. So once I told him that the human, your quality of thinking will be all over the place, and it'll be fluent, it'll be stuck, and both are normal and both are random. Now, the first thing he said to me when I said that was, are you telling me that when I'm throwing the ball and I bounce it back to the pitcher, I'm not supposed to do anything about that to try to fix it? I said, I'm not saying that, although I'm thinking it, to be honest with you. I said, I'm telling you that if you bounce the ball back to the pitcher, it is for one reason only. Your state of mind has temporarily descended. Your level of awareness has shrunk and the perceptual field closed up on you. That's why you bounce the ball back to the pitcher. It's simply because your state of mind trended downward, and that will happen to all of us. So if you look outside of that system for the fix, you're going to keep throwing the ball that way, basically. And that's my only time I talked about, that's the only time I talked about baseball with them the whole time.
We're going to continue our discussion because we have other questions, and I happen to have one that I'm dying to ask, but unfortunately time controls this podcast, so we'll have to say farewell to our podcast audience. We're going to end it with a quote by somebody who happens to be on the cover of your book, who's a friend, a personal friend, a fan of the clubhouse. He's been here many times, so I'm going to leave the last word to Dan Pink, who wrote, Garrett Kremer has overturned much of the conventional wisdom about coaching and performance. Still Power is an insightful and profound book. And I never question anything that Dan says. So we're going to go with that.
Nice of him.
So thank you so much.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you so much.